Thank you, my dear. Okay, so this is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 26th of December, 2018. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis facilitating, Craig McKee, secretary. Craig, I guess you can go ahead and call what role we have here, huh?
Yeah, yeah. All right. So I have Peter Phillips, David Rold, Barbara Honegger, Peter Ketchum, Kat McGuire, Cheryl Curtis, myself, Craig McKee, David Cole, Michael Diamond, Gilad Atzman, James Hufford, Jessica Coco, Ken Freeland, and Marty Hopper.
Lita Renfrew, I didn't hear my name.
Oh, okay.
So, Rita,
so you must
are
be.
Are you on Skype, Rita?
Am I Nita?
Nita, are you calling on Skype?
No.
No.
I'm calling from my landline. It's a 212 number.
Okay.
I don't see it either up here. Okay.
Sometimes they just, for some reason, they don't show up.
That is very odd. Just there's no record of it whatsoever.
That's because I don't exist sometimes.
Apparently.
Maybe it's because you have such old technology.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Boy, I got to get a phone like that. That's cool. All right. Okay, so then if there's no one else who has not heard his or her name mentioned, then we will proceed to take a look at our minutes that were circulated by Craig from the previous meeting. Any objections to approving the minutes as posted? Hearing none, then we'll any amendment? Hearing none, then we'll take them for approved and move on to consideration of tonight's draft agenda as circulated by me. Any amendment to the agenda, the draft agenda, before we accept it for tonight's use?
This is Barb Honegger. At some point, maybe it's just an announcement. I'd like to bring people up to date on the joint fundraising drive between the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers.
Yep. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll have time after announcements for updates. So we'll try to save a little time for you to do that, Barbara. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So hearing no amendments to the agenda, we will then accept it for tonight's use. And that brings us to item number one on the agenda. And that would be our illustrious guest, Peter Phillips. And introducing him is Cheryl, if she's on board yet. Cheryl, are you back yet?
Yes,
okay,
I am.
Cool. All right.
Okay, great. Well, so, Peter, I'm glad you finally made it on the call. That was not good. So Peter Phillips has been a professor of political sociology at Sonoma State University since 1994. He was the director of the Project Censored from 1996 to 2010 and the president of Media Freedom Foundation from 2003 to 2017. He's been an editor or co-editor of 14 editions of Censored, and co-editor with Dennis Liu of Impeach the President, the case against Bush and Cheney, that came out in 2006, and editor of two editions of the Progressive Guide to Alternative Media and Activism from 1999 to 2004. He was a co-host of the weekly Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio with Mickey Huff from 2010 to 2017, originating from KPFA in Berkeley, and airing on 40 stations nationwide. He teaches courses in political sociology, sociology of power, sociology of media, sociology of conspiracies, and investigative sociology. He was winner of the Firecracker Alternative Book Award for Best Political Book in 1997, the Penn Censorship Award in 2008, the Dallas Smith Award from the Union for Democratic Communications in 2009, and the Pillar Human Rights Award from the National Association of Whistleblowers in 2014. And he lives in the Redwood Forest in Bodega, California. And Peter, thank you so much for joining us and sharing all your knowledge with us. I'm just going to turn it right over to you.
Well,
okay,
thank you very much. You told me to speak for what, 10 minutes?
20.
Oh, 20. Okay.
But
well,
whatever,
that's
whatever
all fine.
Yeah.
And you want to stay on that agenda. You guys are late getting going, but I'm fine.
Yeah, we have time for that.
Okay, great.
Well, one moment, Peter. I'm going to put your... so that there won't be any interruption. We'll unmute you here. And the floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you very much. As you may know, Project Censored was early on was considering 9/11 issues. In our 2003 book, we did a whole chapter on some of the main issues at that time. I participated in a number of the national conferences and had a chapter in the scholars that speak out from David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott on what I call the global dominance group and the people who would have been advocating for 9/11. In the meantime, I've been looking at global elites, and my background is in power elites, going back to my dissertation on the San Francisco Bohemian Club and working on for a long time on C. Wright Mills kinds of power elite studies on U.S. But at the same time that 9/11 happened, we were beginning to see, even before, works called like the Transnational Capitalist Class by sociologist Leslie Sklar from the London School of Economics, where they where they're saying that globalization was resulting in nation states of less importance and multinationals developing greater importance in the world. The writer to my introduction to my book on Giants of Global Power Elite is William I. Robinson, who wrote a book in 2004, A Theory of Global Capitalism, Production, Class, and State in a Transnational World. So we were at that time looking at, and sociologists were beginning to think about, a transnational capitalist class and the, you know, the global 1% and the interconnectedness of them in a variety of ways. It was Rothkopf, David Rothkopf wrote a book called Superclass in 2008, where he said that there were this 1,000th of 1%, 6,000 or 7,000 people in the world that were the Davos attending, private jet flying, mega corporation, interlock policy elites of the world. Well, that's too many to do a sociology of them, so I decided to focus on capital and the global capital elites, which is the core of what we're talking about here. And we identified 18, we identified 17 transnational investment management companies that had $1 trillion in assets individually. Are you guys still there?
Yes, we're all here. But
okay, I keep
everyone's
getting
microphone is silenced except mine and yours, I think.
Oh, okay, I keep getting these sounds.
Sure.
Okay, so BlackRock is the largest with $6 trillion worth of investment capital today. The 17 of them collectively in 2017 had $41 trillion of investment capital that they managed. So this was a very highly concentrated core of capital investment money in the world. The those 17 companies were managed by 199 directors, all of whom I name in the book and individually and identify as their corporate affiliations, which of these big giants they're on, other corporations, their net worth, where they went to school, and their affiliations. So it's a pretty comprehensive review of who the central people of capitalism are in the world today, or as of 2017. Part of the crisis of capitalism means that these people today are controlling $50 trillion worth of wealth. And one of the things that came out in the book is that they're all invested in each other. These 17 giants have over $400 billion just in NASDAQ connections, which is the only ones that I can really publicly access, so that all 17 of them are this giant cluster of interconnected capital that's invested literally everywhere in the world. And, you know, there's Silicon Valley, they're invested in all the countries. They're interconnected with many of the other large investment companies, what I call the near giants, that are 800 billion plus. So there's this centralized capital run by just a few hundred people of in excess now of $50 trillion. It's very center to the power elites in the world. And nation states, intelligence agencies, capitalist systems are all essentially working on their behalf. The capital has to continue to grow. It's mandated to continue to grow. It's like capital is like riding a bicycle. It has to keep going forward. If it stops, the bicycle falls over, and that's called stagnation, and there's massive depression and unrest and collapse. So we see part of that collapse happened in 2008, where they had invested in speculative subprime mortgage loans, and that almost brought down the entire system. It took trillions of dollars of bailouts from central banks all over the world, including the Federal Reserve here in the U.S., to bail them out. They're on a verge of that happening again. And what their biggest problem, they have more capital than they have safe places to investment. And if we look back at this historically, this was a problem back at 9/11. So they need structural changes in order to find safe places for capital investment. One of the places that they do, of course, is speculative investment. That's why they were so heavy in the subprime mortgage loan. The other area, which has been the neoconservative approach to economics, has been buying up the public resources. So whether it's water rights or mineral rights or access to providing transportation systems, anything in the world that they can privatize, they're doing that. And so that's a big part of what's going on in the world today is a privatization. The second big part, and this is what makes me suspicious about 9/11 in terms of reasons to 9/11 to occur, is because 9/11 brought about permanent war in the world. I mean, we had major capital investment, but once the Cold War was over, there was a lot of questioning of whether or not we should continue to have the high level of military investments worldwide, and the U.S. was a leader in that. And so capital expenditures on military and wars creates another permanent way that these investment giants can make return on their capital. So permanent war is an investment opportunity for global capital. All of the giants are invested in Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and all the other armament companies, and so they're it's very much part of protecting global capital's growth and expansion. Now they form policy groups outside of government organizations. So groups like the Council of 30. This is a multi-million-dollar research organization based in D.C. that has 32 members. 31 men. They're central bankers, top economists in the world, all of whom have been keynote speakers at Davos, the World Economic Forum, and they meet regularly and put out policy reports that the World Bank and the IMF and others see as instructions, literally. So this is a private organization, privately funded, that is not governmental, and there's no government involvement. And they are making policy recommendations that the transnational government organizations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and those pay very strict attention to. The other two big private policy groups that were reflective of the transnational capitalist class are the Trilateral Commission, which was founded by Rockefeller in 73, and Brzezinski. He and Brzezinski went to the Bilderberg Group in Europe and participated in their meetings, which are much smaller, a few hundred people. And they thought that was pretty cool. And so they came back and they formed the Trilateral Commission based in New York. Originally, it was Europeans, Japanese, and Americans, but today it represents 40 countries from people all over the world and are making policy reports and policy recommendations that are non-governmental. If you're in government, you're asked to leave the Trial Ethics Commission, and another business leader is nominated from the country or region that's involved. So they were the ones that were behind producing a report about Putin 4 years ago and literally calling for regime change in Russia and blaming Putin for the Crimea and that situation. And they were very much involved in that. The other policy group that's non-governmental is the Atlantic Council. And this is made up of member states from people from member state nations in NATO and NATO affiliates. So there's people, not just all the NATO nations, but others. They meet regularly and put out policy reports about the world. And the Atlantic Council was the one who recently had advised Facebook who to drop. When they dropped 900 people last summer, it was the Atlantic Council who made those recommendations in terms of censorship in that organization. So we have these 389 people, the policy leaders in those three advisory groups and the managers of the corporate money, the investment, the $50 trillion, as what I call the center of global capitalism in the world today. And we name all of them. We also talk about the importance of the what we call the ideologists. That's the major media corporations and the public relations firms that provide content to them. All the major television, the six big ones in the world, all receive content from Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group, which they represent private companies as well as governments, and they put together close to 80% of the news content that's running in the world today on television news, particularly international news. So that, and then the private military, we all know about Blackwater and Casellas is what it's called now, but the G4S, which is the second largest private employer in the world, based out of Great Britain, is the they have 625,000 employees. They do security, mercenary work, intelligence work. They were the ones with the dogs up in the Dakotas attacking the protesters there. They're the largest. So the global power elite could hire their own military, and some of these, Blackwater and G4S, are operating in various countries around the world in counterterrorism activities in addition to the U.S. and NATO's activities there. So the problem with all of this, of course, is that it's increasing a global crisis of inequality. And half the people in the world live on less than $3 a day. 80% of the people in the world live on $10 a day or less. And the bottom, like, quarter is on $1.50 a day. And 30,000 of those people die daily from malnutrition and starvation. So there's this mass slaughter ongoing of people in the world when there's more than enough food to feed everybody. It's just not profitable to sell it. Particularly them, and so it's better just to let them starve and throw away the food than it is for capitalism to feed everybody. So that's what William Robinson calls the crisis of humanity, and then you throw on top of that the environmental crisis, which is quite deadly, and we're facing possible extinction as a human species, and we have just less than a dozen years, according to the UN report, to make major corrections, and then it'll just be too late. You would think that some of that would be occurring, but these global investment companies, they continue to invest in the oil companies, any place they can get a return. They invest in Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola puts out 1.4 billion single-use plastic bottles every year that take 450 years to degrade in the environment, and those, of course, are part of the big plastic float in the ocean. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of consciousness around environmental corrections by the transnational investment companies. They continue to put huge amounts of money, and they make people richer. I mean, Bezos is the richest person in the world at $160 billion. That's Amazon. Each of those giants, they got billions and billions of dollars in Amazon. Some of them have 40 or 50 billion invested in Amazon. So that's one concentrated place that they're putting the money, and Silicon Valley, and a variety of other areas. Anywhere they can get a return, that the money is pushed out. So these 199 people, they are the core managers of this $50 trillion. And they're, I think, one of the reasons 9/11 happened. Not that they initiated it, but certainly 9/11 opened up new markets, new places of investment. It opened up permanent war, and it allowed for U.S. and NATO occupations and invasions of the Middle East, and greater access for capital investment anywhere in the world. So we have 800 bases. We've got special forces operating in 140 countries, either, you know, training troops or killing people. And so that's the American NATO empire of the world, and that is facilitating global capital penetration everywhere in the world. So if a regime is resisting, and they always use the term regime, resisting global capital penetration or trying to do something to undermine the U.S. dollar, like Saddam Hussein did in Iraq, he was selling his oil in euros, that they got rid of him. The same way with Gaddafi in Libya, he needed to be removed because he wanted to get all the African nations to sell oil and gold. So we've been dealing with and trying to allow capital penetration everywhere in the world. There's some negotiations in terms of, like with the Chinese, the whole trade agreement there has been to allow, part of the demands have been to allow U.S. capital investment or global capital investment to own more than 50% of Chinese companies. And they're moving in the direction of allowing that to happen. But Russia's another game, and we would really like to, the Atlantic Council's report really would like to see a regime change in there. I mean, global capital is salivating over the opportunities of oil and gas and mineral resources that Russia offers in that vast landmass. So that's the general reason I think that 9/11 occurred. At least it's a broader sociological reason to free up capital investment and any resistance to capital in the world. And it allowed that. That doesn't, of course, answer provide the answer of who did it. But I think it provides a structural understanding of why this happened at that time, because this is when it was really starting to change and manifest itself. So I had a long, nice talk with David Griffin about this too, and he seemed to think that was pretty feasible. So this is the first time I did give a speech about this at the 9/11 Film Festival in Oakland. I don't mention anything about 9/11 in the Giants book. I didn't think that was appropriate because I just wanted to establish that there is this global power elite and who they are. But I think if we look at this historically, they've been there, and certainly the neocons are part of it. Still, some of the PNAC people are now in the Atlantic Council. So I think that that there's some structural understanding that how the global power elite were influential and benefited directly from what happened on 9/11. So I think I just did 20 minutes.
Ah, I think you did too, and very well too. So we're going to go into Q&A. First of all, let me unmute Craig here. We will go into Q&A mode. And so remember, if you want to ask a question of Professor Phillips, then you press star 6, and you will automatically appear in the queue, and you'll be able to ask your question and make your comment in turn. While we're waiting for that queue to form, Professor Phillips, I have a question I'm sure is a little off the wall, but a little memory test for you. Can you remember back when Project Censored was still an academic project, and you received an unsolicited $50 check in the mail? Do you recall that? Oh, hang on. I think I may have muted you. Let me see if that's true. You may have gotten muted when we went into Q&A. Let's see if that's true.
Yeah, he did take him off.
Yeah, okay. I got it. Okay.
Am I on now?
Yeah, you're on now, Professor. Go ahead. Do you recall that?
Was that from you?
That was for me.
Well, thank you very much.
I, of course, don't remember
that.
You don't?
We would get hundreds of checks in the mail from a variety of people all over for years. But we've always been academic. It's just that the project now under Mickey Huff, who I originally met at a 9/11 conference.
Well, I thought Mickey was the first to make a contribution because you were a bit flustered by it. You said, well, we don't usually get contributions. I have to figure out what I can do with this. And then you said, well
that must have been early on. I took over from Carl Jensen at Sonoma State after he'd been here 20 years. And so it was only at Sonoma State. It was a few years later, some of the campuses, San Francisco and Mickey's campus, Diablo Valley, had it in. Now we have about 15 campuses that participate in Project Censored annually.
Wow.
We're still putting
a
book out. I did write a chapter for it this year, but I'm not in charge of the annual Censored book anymore. You know, I did 14 of them. That was enough.
Yeah. Well, it's a monumental project. Okay, so we have several people a couple of people in the queue here who would like to join the conversation. So let's go to Kat McGuire. Go ahead, Kat.
It was very impressive that you did your thesis on the Bohemian Grove. And having looked at the list of the top powerful people, none of them seem to be from Bohemian Grove type real plutocrats. And so they seem to be more functionaries who work for those true overlords. So in your research, both for the Bohemian Grove and for this book, in talking about naming names, who are the real powerful people who those functionaries work for and who you discovered at Bohemian Grove? And if I may add, I find it hard to believe that Jeff Bezos is really the most richest person in the world, as they're all touting, given that he does not have multi-generational wealth like a Rothschild or a Rockefeller or a Bush. So who are those true ruling elites, not the bureaucratic functionaries?
Well, that's an important question to ask, but then there's some assumptions, and there's some theoretical assumptions there in terms of power elites ruling the world in small clusters. That's why I wrote this book, because I think the agenda for elites wherever is to protect global capital and global capital expansion. Now, certainly members of the club are doing that, and I did my dissertation work 24 years ago, so there were very high-level elites at the Bohemian Grove. But I see that more, and I'm actually starting a new book on them. But I see them more as a power cluster or power center in the world, where I've actually used the terminology power circle, where elites drop in. They're reinforced. They get to talk about issues and share things. But the Grove doesn't make policy. People at the Grove who go there are, in fact, in places where they can make policy and implement behaviors. But to try to say who's a functionary and who's not, I think that these elites and the policy councils that I mentioned, certainly I think the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism is a G30, the Council of 30. They get more say on policies in the capital world today than anywhere. And I think also that the Atlantic Council has a whole lot to do to say as to what wars were going, which doesn't diminish the Council of Foreign Relations, but their emphasis has been on U.S. policy and not global as much. And they have a global advisory group now, but it's really in the developmental stages, and they don't use it very well. So Larry Shoup and I have had this conversation, you know, about the Council of Foreign Relations, and I didn't include them as part of the giants network or the global power elite. And you know, I'm trying to narrow this down to a very small set of people. So there's only 389 people named in the book. But they are all in positions of power that they could really make significant changes. I mean, they could decide that the economic collapse is inevitable, which I believe is, and a number of scholars believe it's inevitable. And they could decide that there needs to be capitalism keep growing and concentrating, and they need to reverse that. And instead of trickle down, which it doesn't trickle down at all, but there would be a river down. And we actually write a letter in the back signed by 90 scholars and friends of mine that saying that you guys need to fix this. And we need to, and the 99% need to be pressuring them to fix this, short of global collapse, economic collapse, and environmental destruction. So who's a functionary? I mean, Trump's a functionary. The presidents are functionaries in that sense because they're in service to global capital. They're in service to Wall Street and protecting global capital interests. And these giants, I mean, this is the real core, the money. This isn't like Amazon's a $1 trillion company, right? But they've got buildings and patents and all kinds of other stuff of value. We're talking here the giants that are managing cash. This $50 trillion of cash management by these 199 people, they get to decide where it goes and what and how it's invested. So and they are very closely interconnected. So I stand that they are the central core of global capitalism, and that's what's empowering, you know, is empowering the world today.
Okay. Thank you.
Which doesn't exclude a Rothschild and other people from who are influential, but it's, you know, it's different than the British Empire was 100 years ago.
Okay. Barb Honegger's next. Go ahead, Barb.
Oh, hi, Peter. Barb Honegger. Great to have you on.
How are you?
Yeah, great to have you on. I'm going to be seeing Bonnie Faulkner here in a few days in the Monterey Peninsula.
Yeah,
we
lost her at KPFA, which was a tragedy.
I know.
I've retired from KPFA, too. I just get tired of all their bullshit.
Right. I mean, the politics was horrible.
It was really terrible.
I'd like everybody to know before I ask my question that Gilad Atzmon, who is on this call, is going to be speaking here in the Monterey Peninsula on January 4th, that's a Friday, at 12:30, free Mediterranean lunch at the Peace and Justice Center in Seaside, California. So anybody who'd like to come who's in the area, anywhere in California, come here, Gilad. Okay, so here's my question. My question, it's interesting you should have mentioned the British Empire and, you know, 100 years ago, and everybody assumes that Britain really doesn't have any significant geopolitical power anymore. I had a personal experience, I'm going to give you in a nutshell, that told me otherwise. And that was when I was doing my book, October Surprise, I had to do a chronology before I could figure out exactly what the causal links were. To actually write the text of the book. And this is in 1989. And I had completed, it was actually 1987, during the Iran-Contra period on TV in the hearing. And I did this chronology and sent it to the senior White House correspondent, who was my political godmother at the time, Sarah McClendon. Sarah, in turn, after she got it by mail, it was 76-page chronology, basis of my book, October Surprise, on Iran-Contra. The Iran side of Iran-Contra, the deep story. So she called me up about 10 days later, and she said that I had to go to Washington, that there was someone extremely important wanted to meet me. And I said, who? She wouldn't tell me. Bottom line is, she insisted that I come, not knowing who this mystery person was. I had to borrow money from Daniel Sheehan, the world-famous attorney. And he was a buddy of mine here in the Monterey Peninsula for 40 years. And so I borrowed the money, and I got to Washington. Sarah had a driver pick me up, take me to her place. And so Sarah still wouldn't tell me who the mystery person was until the next day. I was to meet him at the Sarah McClendon dining room at the National Press Club. I go there. She doesn't go in with me. She said, no, he wants to meet you alone. Well, the bottom line is it was Colonel Fletcher Prouty. Air Force Colonel Fletcher Prouty. And at that meeting, he opened his briefcase and handed me my chronology that I had sent to Sarah. And the bottom line of this is, he asked me if I had written it. I said, yes. Did you write every word? Did you do it all? I said, yes. And then he said, can I have it back? She had given him a Xerox, of course. And then he put it back in his briefcase. It was just the two of us in the Sarah McClendon dining room at the National Press Club. He puts it back in his briefcase. He puts his hands, clasps his hands on this little table for two. Nobody else in the Sarah McClendon dining room at the National Press Club. He leans into me. He's in his full dress uniform, white. He leans into me and he says, the people who run the world are trained and initiated at Haley Berry Academy. If you decide to join us, just let me know. Here's my card. Now, there was no question in my mind that he was trying to recruit me, not for American intelligence, not for the CIA or the FBI, it for British intelligence. So I just want to ask you, are you sure that the Brits are not – what that told me is, by the way, that the Brits think of the United States still as one of their colonies. So I'd just like your comments on this experience.
Well, and Barclays Bank, of course, is one of the most interconnected banks in the world. Swiss study told us that a few years back. They sold off a major portion of their investment portfolio to BlackRock, which made them the largest at that time. And now they are back up well over a trillion themselves. So, but Barclays and, you know, the Bank of England certainly were closely interconnected, and all of the major players in Britain are still there. I think that, you know, the British are very, very powerful. And in my elite network here, they're in every one of the groups, the Trilateral Commission, and of course, it's Dutch and British capital that kind of put has the Bilderberg group was behind, and it's Europeans that predominantly are organized around Davos, which is another what I call a power circle place for people to drop in. There's like 3,000 people that go to Davos every year, and you've got to be in the top 1,000 corporations to be able to attend. And it costs $25,000, and they'll send each corporation can send five people, as long as one's a woman. So that's their affirmative action thing. The difference, of course, with the Bohemian Club is they don't allow women at the Bohemian Grove. But I think there's other power circles in the world, Aspen being one. But this is where elites drop in, and they interconnect with each other, and they meet each other, and they do business deals, and they celebrate themselves in a variety of ways. But the policy-making stuff is really about protecting global capital. And it's the transnational state organizations, the World Bank, the IMF, the international settlements, those that are, in fact, regulating and controlling the agreements of global capital and the rules. And those are nation states, and they're dominated by the richest nation states. So they're dominated by Britain and U.S. and Germany and France. But overall, the independence of capital and its need to grow and expand is their agenda item. They know that it has to happen if they want to see it continue. So everywhere in the world that there's any interference, they will get in, and intelligence agencies will work on behalf of global capital and fix it. That could be British or the U.S. We know they were all meeting during the Carter administration in Africa at the Safari Club to try to deal with Carter because he wasn't being as supportive as they wanted.
Right. Okay, well, thanks for your answer. I just wanted you to know what happened with Fletch Prouty. He was, no question in my mind, he was working for the British.
Have you written that down anywhere?
Well, I've done radio interviews. I can send you the links.
Okay, that'd be great. I'd like to hear that.
Okay.
All right. We're about out of time on this, but I guess Kat would like to make one more quick comment. So, Kat, please be brief, and let's keep the answer brief as we can so we can move on. Go ahead, Kat.
Yes, I was just wondering how the whole central bank, IBS and fiat capital, fiat currency fit in with that.
Well, how did it happen? We certainly know what happened.
No. How come? How is it that is not a central point? Was it a central point in your book? And why is that not? If not, why is that not like a main focus?
I think central banks work on behalf of global capital growth and expansion. They bailed it out. I mean, yeah, they're there. And they do provide capital, and it's literally given to banks to loan out, and that's how it creates a monetary systems. To say that they are the central core of global power, a lot of these people, the central bankers and the Federal Reserve folks are on the Council of 30. They're on these boards. So I can't answer why specifically in terms of what you're asking me, but it's certainly something to think about.
I would just think it is so so very important that would be a key aspect of capitalism's power is the stranglehold that central banks have over government's money. And that you would have like really gone into that more.
Yeah, well, this $50 trillion isn't government money; it's privately held. But it's the main core capital investment money in the world. So that's what's being protected. It's private capital. I know that the central banks can create it, and they do, but they create it to protect and expand global capital to continue to allow to expand and grow. So it's the same people that are running global capital that are on these central banks and the Federal Reserve. A whole bunch of Federal Reserve people are in this book and central bankers from all over the world.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Professor Phelps, we sure want to thank you for spending the time with us tonight and enlightening us as to the contents of your new book, which hopefully has sparked an interest and will lead to some Amazon.com or other purchases of the book in the near future by those
well, thank
who
you.
Want
and
to pursue it further.
Thank you. Any professors that want a copy, consider using it in class. Just send me an email and I'll make sure you get one.
Hey, there we go. Can't beat that. That's a bargain at twice the price. Okay. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Now we'll move on to our second guest, who is probably muted. Let's see. Yep, he is. So let's unmute him. And let's see. That would be James Hufford also. He's going to give us our formal introduction of our next guest. So take it away, James.
Okay. Well, Dane, thank you for accepting our invitation, and first of all, and I've been interested in Dane's work for several years because I think he offers the only alternative I've seen to global climate change, which I don't think in and of itself is argued against very much now. I think it's fairly universally accepted that as something that is happening, but it's the usual conventional narrative is that that's due to industrialization and the effects of industrialization in the private sector, and Dane's work, at least in my eyes, presents a good alternative with a lot of it due to government programs. So I think that's very interesting to consider. Dane is the he's a Californian. He's lives in Shasta County, and he is the lead researcher for geoengineeringwatch.org, and he's investigated all levels of geoengineering. He's a former employee of Bechtel Power Corporation and was a licensed contractor in California and Arizona. He's been engaged in constant climate geoengineering research for the past 15 years, and that's about the size of it. I think nobody's better qualified to do the work that he's doing, and I just want to turn it over to Dane.
Thank you, James. I appreciate the invite to the call. I appreciate everybody that's listening in on the call. And I want to premise this with the acknowledgement that I absolutely, completely recognize all forms of anthropogenic damage to the climate. I lectured on anthropogenic global warming prior to making the decision to focus all on the climate engineering, geoengineering, solar radiation management issue. Because from a data standpoint, there can really be no legitimate discussion about the climate without including that factor. And that is not to say any of the other factors should be ignored. And although there are many in the anti-geoengineering community that unfortunately choose to deny the other forms of anthropogenic damage to the climate, which is very unfortunate, we at Geoengineering Watch absolutely fully acknowledge all forms of damage to the planet, the dumping of 100 million tons of CO2 in the atmosphere every day, the cutting down of the forest, paving of the planet. All those are absolutely major factors. But the climate engineering issue is being categorically ignored and denied. And this is very unfortunate. And James, I assume the listeners are they somewhat familiar with the climate engineering issue? I want to make this as brief as I can. Would there be any recognition on the call of the geoengineering issue itself?
Oh, I don't think so. We haven't discussed that in the past. We have had pretty heated debates over the anthropogenic cause of the phenomena, but that's about it.
I'll make this short and brief then. Bottom line, we have the entirety of academia discussing the threat we face from, I would argue it's much worse than global warming. I would argue we face an abrupt climate collapse. We have been horrible stewards of the planet. I wouldn't know where to start. I would have spent all my days restoring habitat if I could, planting trees in the forest. I've done habitat restoration on a major scale, industrial scale, working with federal agencies. But it soon became apparent there was little point doing that when the trees we planted died in Northern California. Our success rate over the last 15 years has gone from 95% of the seedlings planted, making it through the first year, to zero. Zero. We tested precipitation. We found the same elements listed in climate engineering patents, specifically aluminum, barium. We have CARB air quality studies proving those elements were not coming from China. They were not migrating across the Pacific. It had to be local origin. There's no industry. It was so much metal coming down in our precipitation. Again, primary elements named in climate engineering patents. So much metal was coming down. It was changing forest floor pH values. And I work directly with USDA scientists, former Forest Service scientists, Fish and Game. We're not guessing. We have about 70 lab tests in Northern California alone. My home was on the cover of the world's largest renewable energy magazine. I am completely off-grid because of my concerns about the environment. I would have spent my final days in the forest trying to restore habitat, but when I began to lose massive amounts of my solar power uptake, again, that's my background, from whatever these aircraft were emitting, that could not be condensation. Absolutely cannot block 60, 70, 80% of my solar power uptake. And I began to research primary elements in climate engineering patents, starting with aluminum, state-certified lab, found the material there, massively escalating from one rain event to the next. In fact, over a year-and-a-half period from about 2004 to 2005, escalating 50,000% from 7 parts per billion to about 3,500 parts per billion. And I was faced with a dilemma that with this going on, there was no point in my habitat restoration. It was a superseding factor relating directly to climate change, that was not being acknowledged, so I focused the last 15 years on this. So solar radiation management is scientifically stated, the intent to create solar obscuration to block some of the sun's incoming thermal radiation as a stopgap measure for our planetary meltdown. Problem is this. The negative consequences have not been addressed in any way, shape, or form. No environmental impact reports whatsoever. In fact, I confronted, and your listeners can look at this online if they search Dane Wigington, David Keith. Dr. David Keith is the world's most recognized geoengineer from Harvard. I confronted him at an international conference after a 3.5-hour symposium where he was pushing the goal, the objective of dumping 20 million tons of aluminum nanoparticulates into the atmosphere to increase the Earth's albedo, its reflectivity. After that symposium, I asked Dr. Keith, had any toxicological studies been done whatsoever, human health effects, environmental toxicity? After trying to dodge the question, he finally stated this. No, we haven't studied the consequences. Could terrible things happen tomorrow? We don't know. I was banned from subsequent conferences. So I've dedicated the last 15 years of my life to this issue. Our site is absolutely non-political. We have a major global warming section on the site called Global Meltdown, acknowledging the atmospheric buildup of methane, acknowledging the consequences of our dying oceans converting to what we should already technically refer to as Canfield Ocean, hypoxic and anoxic zones in the ocean, the dead zones, and all of this adding up. But my point is this, that if we have, and we have 800-page Senate documents to prove that these programs have been ongoing for decades, in fact, started at scale immediately after World War II. We have other recorded historical events, Project Cirrus, the manipulation of hurricanes, Project Storm Fury, lots of historical precedent. This issue has been taboo because it is an issue that would directly affect the funding of various people, especially in universities. We know this for a fact. I've had university people who have some very close to this conversation who have invited me to speak at university and then canceled me when I feel that they were told not to address this issue. That has happened more than once. We have people from major universities that we were communicating with that were told, don't address the geoengineering issue again or there'll be consequences. We know who they are. We haven't heard from them since. We have state biologists that were told the same. We have a legal team. We're already suing in Canada. Our legal team solicited for FOIA's Freedom of Information Act requests from NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. By the way, for the record, there is a legal federal gag order right now on all National Weather Service and all NOAA employees. NOAA was not giving us our FOIA's. We had to sue and are currently suing the U.S. Department of Commerce to get our FOIA's. We've already gotten a number of them. We have more going in this week. We know from those FOIA's that the local meteorologists, all the way down to the local meteorologist level, are being told, they're being given a script. They're literally reading a script because those at the top that do the modeling, which is Raytheon, the major geoengineering contractor, are passing that script down and they're interested in consistency of message, not accuracy. So we know a lot and we're learning more every day. But the bottom line is, and I don't know how long I had, James, but I want to stop early so that I can answer questions if we have any. But The point and purpose of our site, we're the biggest site in the world on the subject, over 32 million visitors, non-political, no advertising. We simply want to gain disclosure. And we have been cut off at every pass because with agencies, environmental groups, our attorneys have spoken to WWF, Earth Justice, Sierra Club, Greenpeace. All of them are worried about losing their 501 nonprofits. And again, with climate engineering, the ramifications are so grave. And I don't say that lightly because I am absolutely meticulously aware of all the forms of damage to our planet. I am an environmentalist to the core. But how can we have, and I'll end with this, how can we have any legitimate discussion about the climate and the state of the climate and the state of the global meltdown, which I fully acknowledge, and every contributing factor I fully acknowledge, but how can we have a legitimate discussion without including covert global climate engineering, solar radiation management programs, which are absolutely positively occurring? We have the data, the lab tests, the film footage, photographs of nozzles mounted on the pylons, up-close film footage of KC-10s, KC-135, C-17 Globemasters spraying, turning on and off, nozzles visible, lab tests from the ground. We have global dimming now that's pushing 30%. That's the express goal of climate engineering. how can we have any legitimate discussion about the climate without discussing and including climate engineering programs, which are wreaking havoc with what's left of Earth's remaining life support systems? I'll take questions from there. I don't know how long I have, James. I don't want to go over my limit, James.
Yeah. That's perfectly nice timing. And so we're still in question and answer mode. So, folks, if you want to ask a question or make a comment, star 6 will put you in the queue and we'll take you in turn. First in the queue is Jessica. Go ahead, Jessica.
Hello?
Jessica Coco. Yeah, you're on.
Oh, okay. Excuse me. By the way, I work with the Department of Commerce. Speaking of the Department of Commerce, and they do tell the employees, kind of like the unofficial official line is that yes, we're doing geoengineering. It's a last-ditch effort to stop global warming. And yes, the chemicals are toxic, but the few have to sacrifice for the many. We have coworkers. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you finish. I thank you. I just want to express my gratitude. I have a follow-up to your thank you. Go ahead. Continue. I'll chime in.
You should probably call me. We should probably speak about this. But
I would love to.
My main issue is that
James can pass that on if he knows how to. If you don't want to announce it on the air here, on the call. But I would definitely be interested in conversing with you. And I think, off the record, we can keep you completely confidential. Our attorneys would be very interested in speaking to you too. And again, we guarantee your anonymity until you say otherwise.
I mean, my great issue is how do we organize? I'm not sure how successful you are on the West Coast, but in the East Coast, I mean, we really need to organize. Like, there's going to be like not New Age. The name of it is. I apologize. I had a really long day.
It's okay.
We have like a New Life Expo. I'm not sure if we can get maybe an arrangement where we could speak. I'm not the greatest public speaker, but we should be in events like this where we have some. Where we have dialogue, and maybe this is other people in the 9/11 movement who would like to join me. That would be great in the New York, New Jersey area.
One of our lead attorneys works with the 9/11 group as well. Part of our problem is the time frame. On the current trajectory, none of us will be here very long, as was correctly stated. The collapse of the biosphere, I would argue we don't have 12 years, I think as was stated earlier. Mathematically speaking, with the current rate of wildlife die-off, we've lost over 60% in the last 40 years. On the current trajectory, with the already graphable increases in the die-off rate, we're looking at 0 hour for no wildlife left by 2026. Ozone depletion, we're working with former NASA contract engineer now with equipment we supplied him. And the current rate of ozone loss, we're looking at ozone collapse by 2025 or 2026. Hmm. We have converging cataclysms. Again, I recognize all the forms of anthropogenic damage that contribute. But the climate engineering issue, especially when we're talking about the ozone collapse, the protracted droughts that are fueling the epic forest fires, which we believe data indicates the geoengineers are actually utilizing wildfire smoke from northern latitude fires to help temporarily cool the Arctic. At what cost, though? At what cost? We've done extensive reports on this with the science, peer-reviewed studies, to prove that they named massive northern hemisphere smoke particulate loading into the atmosphere as a desirable cooling factor for the Arctic. So we have a behavior pattern from the climate engineering cabal, which is global, and we have Senate documents to prove this is global, and that outlines the cooperation between governments that have otherwise conflicting interests. But they are so out of control, and the impact to the climate system is now so immense that this issue simply must be disclosed. And Jessica, if James can connect us in some way off this call. I don't want Jessica to disclose on air, but can you connect us in some way?
Well, I can't, but maybe Ken can.
Jessica, you can
share. I'll be happy to make the connection, Jessica. If you want to give me permission, I can send your contact info to Jane, and he can go take it from there if that's okay with you.
Yes, that would be great.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
Okay,
I've had a NOAA employee state to my face. We all know what's going on. We're, in her words, alarmed as hell. We don't know what to do. We have no First Amendment protection. Now we have a federal gag order. So this elephant in the room needs to be acknowledged. And again, the payroll for some, like 350.org, Bill McKibben, as an example, getting money from the Rockefeller Foundation. Amy Goodman, whom I've met twice, they've been given abundant data, won't touch this issue, receiving money from the Ford Foundation. So my argument, my point would be this, that if the ship is sinking, telling half the truth won't do it. There's either the whole truth or something other than the truth. And this issue simply, if we care about the environment, obviously no environment, no us, this issue must be disclosed. And one more point, if I can make, James, the two things we disclosed at geoengineeringwatch.org about nearly a decade before it was officially acknowledged, we disclosed that the insect populations were collapsing. This is via my work with former fish and game scientists and former U.S. Forest Service scientists. We disclosed nearly 10 years ago that we were seeing about an 80% decline in terrestrial and aquatic insects in Northern California. I think most people on this call probably know that's been officially acknowledged now. But across the board, the overall data from ozone collapse, from contamination of soils and waters, changing pH values in the forest floor, which is killing everything, from climate engineering fallout and the contamination that's within that. And we do have peer-reviewed study to prove what aluminum does to the root systems, causes them to shut down nutrient uptake. We can document all of this. We simply need to get the word out, and we're doing our best to do exactly that.
Okay.
When I press star 6, I don't know if I get through. I've had trouble.
You're already unmuted, James.
Okay,
you introduced
great.
The speaker. Yeah.
It's probably not my. Is it my turn?
Yeah. If you want to go ahead and ask a question, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to suggest something pretty dire, actually, Dane, and that is that all of the terrible things that you've heralded here. I'm wondering if possibly all of those are known by the powers that be, and it's just too late, and the reason that you can't make any headway is because they think it's too late anyway, and they might as well just let it go instead of scaring everybody to death. I'm wondering if that could be the case.
I think you're exactly right. That is their mentality. But I would argue this. What you have to add to that mentality is the fact that they are not about to disclose what they have done for 70 years had they never deployed climate engineering. I would argue, scientifically, statistically, we would be in exponentially better shape now. The ozone layer would not be in tatters. We would not have a contaminated scenario. We would have more rain. On a warming planet, you must have more rain. 7% more moisture for every degree C of warming. So instead of a burnt-down, dying northern latitude forests, they would be trying to uptake some of the additional CO2 with additional precipitation, fueling that. None of that can take place with climate engineering. So they are simply too committed. And they are also using this for weather warfare. We know that. In fact, General Wesley Clark, 1 week after 9/11, stated on the record all the countries that were going to be taken out in the Middle East. Is it a coincidence that every one of those countries has undergone a once-in-1,000-year drought since, destabilizing them, making them easier to topple? That's not a coincidence. We have the leaders of those countries, in the case of Iran, stating on the record that their precipitation was being cut off by NATO weather modification warfare. So it's weather warfare. So there are many, many layers to this, ultimately about power and control. And although, James, I agree with you in their mindset does not take into account that their unwillingness to let go of power, which in their mind might mean it's too late to stop these programs, and the liability to them would be you'd have people in the streets all over the planet with their pitchforks and torches looking for who's responsible if they find out. Yeah. But for the planet, from the planetary standpoint, I would argue if we do not stop climate engineering, we have zero chance for near-term survival. If we stop, if the planet's allowed to respond, if the ozone layer is allowed to recover, obviously industrialization and all the other forms of human activity have to be brought to a halt as well. But if we can stop climate engineering and allow the planet to respond to the damage already done, we would at least buy some time.
Yeah. Well, we got to do what we got to do.
I fully agree. And we offer at geoengineeringwatch.org for your listeners informational material, again, non-political, It's on our home site. You can share links for free. We give full PDF links. You can print your own materials from our PDFs. We print in mass quantity and pass that on for our approximate cost of the production and mailing. So it's, you know, very, very cost effective that way as well. We just simply want to get the materials into circulation. But all that can be found on the homepage of geoengineeringwatch.org.
Okay.
Next up is Michael Diamond. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah. Dane, it's yes, Michael Diamond. We've spoken.
Yes, Michael. How are you?
I'm from New Jersey. I've been involved with 9/11 for many years, and I've been involved with your work for many years, assiduously. You are so correct and so courageous. I just want to let everyone on the call know that you're a champion. I'm going to continue doing whatever I can do here in New Jersey, and I'll continue to work on the issue of treason. I think that that's been triggered. I'll be in touch with it separately if I'm able to come up with something usable. But in the meantime, I just have to say, keep going, brother. Just keep going. Love your work.
Thank you, Michael. I want to extend the same gratitude back to your work as well. And I feel for myself, I'm simply doing what any decent man, citizen, inhabitant of the planet would do. And I will press on no matter what. But I just feel I'm manning a post that needs to be manned.
Amen.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Kat McGuire. Go ahead, Kat.
Yes, hi. I'm not understanding how the deciders, whoever are calling the shots and the minions who support them, how they think they're going to get around from not being, have the consequences affect them themselves. They don't have to eat pesticided food. They don't have to take vaccines. There's a lot of things they can evade, but how do they not get the consequences of something that's so planetary and nano and hard to evade?
Very, very important question. Why would they do this to themselves? I would first offer the example of the 2,000-plus nuclear detonations on planet Earth, which contaminated all life forms. Everything in the web of life was contaminated, but they did it anyway. Let's look at Fukushima, an ongoing, perhaps extinction event if other factors don't do the job first, which I would argue will be the case. And they're building 60 more nuke plants right now. What we have is a cancer that runs the planet. It is very parallel to a cancer, and I would argue, does a cancer intend to kill the host? No. And a cancer simply intends to proliferate. The host inevitably dies. And that's the case that we have here. And they look at this as a risk-to-risk scenario. To weave this into what James said, the risk of doing it versus the risk of not doing it. We're obviously already geoengineering the planet with human activity, anthropogenic activity. It's everything that affects the energy balance of the planet is a form of geoengineering. But because they are unwilling to let go of their stranglehold on power, now that they have committed to something that has done incalculable damage to every living thing on the planet and the Earth's life support system, disclosure now would mean, I would argue, a shockwave all over the globe, again, catalyzing populations in every country against all their governments who are all either actively or passively involved, with the exception of some countries like Iran. There's a few others. But they are too committed to this to turn back. So like the pharmaceutical cure for the human body, and if you hear the pharmaceutical cure, you take it for a certain symptom and you hear the side effects and can't imagine anybody would take that, but they do. That's their mentality. So the more damage they do, and let me give an example of this, the more damage they do from climate engineering, by the way, which mathematically speaking is the single greatest factor with ozone destruction. The ozone layer is not recovering. That's a lie. We're reading UV. We're getting UVC on the surface now. UV spectrum is UVA, UVB, UVC, and then X-ray. We're told UVC stops 100,000 feet up. It's on the surface now. We know that. It's killing plankton, killing trees, and killing everything in between. So the bottom line is, as they continue with these programs, instead of backing off, seeing the global cataclysm that's unfolding directly related to these programs on top of everything else, they simply keep doubling down and doubling down. And here's an example with the buildup of methane in the atmosphere, which climate engineering is making worse overall, not better. It masks the symptoms at the cost of making it worse. So now we have Project Lucy and Project Alamo, which we believe are fully deployed. Those are acronyms that refer to the microwaving of the atmosphere in a desperate and unimaginably destructive attempt to degrade methane in the atmosphere molecularly. So That's one example of, just like the pharmaceutical cure, when you start to get side effects, you take more pharmaceuticals for those side effects and even more for those side effects. Same mentality here. Same mentality. Cancer, it's a cancer that's running the planet, and the host, i.e. planet Earth, will die if we press on in this course in the unimaginably short term. And again, I'm not in any way denying all other forms of human damage to the planet. I could give a full, very qualified presentation on anthropogenic global warming and its causes right now, but I'm simply saying there can't be a legitimate discussion about the state of the climate without including this issue. And we need people in universities and other places to start showing the courage to allow this subject to be introduced. And right now we don't see that. We see people that are worried about their paychecks and pensions, same with environmental groups, same with agencies. None of that will make much difference on a dead planet. And we are very, very close to that point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kat.
Okay. And last in the queue looks like is Barbara. Go ahead, Barbara.
Can I get on the end as well?
Sure, you'd be behind Barbara then. Yeah.
Thank
you. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Who am I speaking with?
This is Barbara Honegger. Hi, Dean.
Hi, how are you?
Yes. All right. So this is my question. I, unfortunately, for the first at least half of your presentation, the volume was so low I couldn't hear a word. But I've heard you, I believe, on Bonnie Faulkner, so I know the gist of what you're saying. So my if I understood correctly, having not being able to hear the first part, I believe that one of your messages is we would be a lot better off. It would be a huge shock to the system. But in the long term, we would be a lot better off if they just stopped all the geoengineering. That's my question, and then I have a comment if that's true. Is that true?
Data supports that conclusion. And when you stop geoengineering, there is a scientific term. It's called double catastrophe scenario. And certainly the blowback will be horrific. After 70 years of stratospheric aerosol injection and the microwaving of those particles to help manipulate and disperse them, the climate blowback will be horrific, but it must be allowed to happen. To do otherwise is to tell the heroin addict that he just needs to keep upping his dose, that the withdrawals will be too severe. But in fact, without stopping the addiction, they die. The planet will die as well. So again, we will buy time. I'm not in any way stating our problems are over. I'm not stating that. But I'm saying if we don't stop and allow the planet to respond, starting with the ozone layer and the hydrological cycle, we're done even sooner.
Okay. So you've answered my question with a yes. So this is my comment and question. And that is the example of South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The basic idea here is, if you believe that the fundamental reason, the corporatist capitalist reason, that they haven't come clean, disclosed, and stopped, despite the blowback, the double jeopardy or whatever, is because of their legal liability. If that is a major factor, is anyone seriously proposing a global immunity, a legal immunity, in exchange for the truth and stopping?
Well, let me answer that from one of our documents, which is, again, an 800-page U.S. Senate document. That in that document from 1978 specifically outlines the fact that anyone, everyone involved with these programs already has legal immunity, total immunity. But we're talking about something on a much higher level now that nobody, I would argue, when citizens around the globe find out what has been done to them, in every country, without their knowledge or consent, we're talking about an overturning of the paradigm. There's nobody on this planet that hasn't been horrifically harmed. At the point in time you intervene with the entire climate system, you can no longer call any event natural, none. So in addition to the liability factor, we also have the weather warfare factor, the commodities trading factor, the gambling casino on weather trading derivatives. We have many making money on that, again, compared to pirates on the deck of a sinking ship filling their pockets with loot as if that will help them. But I would argue the liability issue is much greater than any legal ramifications. We're talking about societal chaos all over the globe as people take to the streets with their pitchforks and torches if they find out. I would argue that's the level we're at.
All right. And last question. Have you communicated directly with Daniel Sheehan, world famous attorney? And the reason I ask is he and his wife, his true partner, Sarah Nelson, who are right here in Santa Cruz, 40-year close colleagues and friends of mine, very close friends. They are two of a handful of people who are on the Global Warming Climate Change Advisory Committee to the Pope. Have you ever spoken directly one-on-one with Daniel Sheehan?
No, I believe someone from our team did. I'm not certain of that, but I believe one of our attorneys did. And you know, I can't confirm that with certainty.
Okay. Well, would you be willing to?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. I'll do my best to put you.
We just heard from an attorney today. We just had contact from an attorney today that was disbarred from the Florida bar for bringing this issue up, was threatened with having to take psych exams for just bringing this issue up. So think how Orwellian our world is when we have every science institution in the world discussing this. Yeah, we have to do exactly what we see in the sky. Even though you see it in the sky, that's not really what you think you see. It's just something we have to do. I mean, that's how absurd a world we live in, but we just opened up a line of communication with an attorney right now that was barred from practicing in Florida for bringing this issue up, and he's livid.
In what sense did he bring it up? Was there a complaint in court, a lawsuit?
No. He wasn't even filing suit. He just simply, I don't have all the details yet. We're just opening communication. You know, we're keeping him confidential for the moment. But that's how serious the scenario is. We have a state. There's a very big environmental issue in the state of California, the Delta smelt issue, and the head state biologist working on that issue. They were finding aluminum adhered to the fish's gills, to the smelt's gills. Every time he tried to bring that up, he was absolutely reprimanded right out the window. We're dealing with former Fish and Game top water quality biologists. Same scenario across the board. Anybody who dares to bring this issue up is dealt with severely. They are doing everything they can to keep this issue off the public radar. Because if it hits the radar, if it comes out in the open, again, I would argue we are going to have an overturning of the paradigm in a way that the power structure is not ready to deal with.
Right. Well, with all the problems with the pedophilia scandal in the Catholic Church, they nevertheless have a global audience. And Daniel Sheehan and his partner Sarah Nelson are part of this team, and they want there to be an international tribunal that is initiated by the Vatican on this subject.
I would drop what I was doing to communicate with them anytime. I could arrange communication with our attorneys, some of the scientists working with us. We're working with three former high-ranking U.S. Air Force officers, two major generals, both two-star generals. We have a number of people that we're working with that have stepped forward.
Okay. I'll do my best to put
you in. You can reach me at the contact. Go to geoengineeringwatch.org under the contact link, and if you put Attention Dane in big letters, it will be brought to my attention.
All right. Very good. And I'm Barbara Honegger. I'll say from Barbara Honegger.
Thank you, Barbara.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of the queue. Thank you very much, Dane.
Ken, you forgot me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
And me also.
Yes. Who else?
Cheryl.
Cheryl. Okay, so our two other officers here each have a question or a comment. So, Craig, you're first, and then Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hi, Craig.
Okay, thanks. Hi, Dane. My name's Craig McKee. I guess I have a sort of a two-parter. One is more of a just a point of fact, I guess. You've mentioned a couple of times about 70 years being the length of time that this has gone on, and I wanted to ask you about that because I've heard a lot of people give different, you know, estimates of when it started, and it seems like about 20 years that I've been really noticing the trails in the sky. So I wonder if it sort of got much heavier in more recent years. So that was kind of my first question. Well, I'll let you answer that one, but I did have a second question.
Short answer is yes. And when you say 20 years, that fits exactly with the time frame we had. Those are familiar with the climate scenario, anthropogenic warming. We had 1998 to that point was the warmest year ever recorded, exactly 20 years ago. and we saw there was a big ramp up then. There's been a number of ramp ups since 2007 when the Arctic ice was really heading toward a BOE, a blue ocean event. Big ramp up began in 2012 when the same situation happened in the Arctic. So many ramp ups along the way. But we even have now, you see people refer to, for example, the World War II bombers like the B-17s, Craig, as proof that this is all just condensation. You've probably heard that argument.
Yes, I have.
We have film footage that we acquired from military archives that show up close B-17s in flight patterns shutting off their spray dispersions. So beta testing was going on then. That was clearly not condensation. We have up-close film footage of it.
Wow.
And we have, again, other data to indicate that the deployment in earnest over the polar regions first, so it would not have been visible to the public. That's when it happened. And everybody on the call might remember that from 1945, when the rate of warming on the planet was heading straight up by the end of World War II. And then there was a leveling off for about 30 years, from 1945 to 1975, so much so that some in the science community were posing the question of why isn't it still warming at the same nonlinear rate. And that data indicates as a direct result of climate engineering operations over the poles, which were, in the eyes of the power structure, successful initially because they were not taking into account the consequences that were building up. So, again, we have lots of data to indicate that the major deployments started after 1945, over the polar regions, branched out from there, and your time frame of seeing a ramp up or noticing them 20 years ago would fit exactly with what we see in the climate record.
That's interesting. I also notice in recent years that it seems like the technology is changing because the trails themselves seem to be often they seem to disappear faster than they used to. And they spread out faster. So I don't know if that's something that's coming from the refinement in their technology. But
depends on the time of year. Now we see dispersions are
okay.
More. You know, of course, in the warmer months, we'll see a dispersion that appears to dissipate, but you still have the silvery white appearance to the sky. You can see a halo around the sun. So the dispersions are still occurring, but we still see the very blatant. We have a website called geoengineeringwatch.org photo gallery. It's on Facebook. We post photos from around the globe every day, the locations, the times listed, and it is absolutely as in your face and blatant and shocking as it could possibly be. Huge Facebook page. It's the biggest photo archive in the planet.
Well, great. The main thing I did want to ask about is I've noticed in recent months there's all kinds of articles in mainstream media talking about how they're going to start, or they're talking about starting the process of geoengineering, and I wondered, I'd like you to comment on that, because it seems like we know they've been doing it for many years, but it's almost like they want to retroactively condition us to accept that this is what's going to happen.
Two things on that point. It's a red herring. They're trying to in academia. Discredit the fact that it's already going on by claiming we haven't even started yet, and has been a very effective distraction for them, and that's really the primary purpose of that. They're testing the water as well, but I would argue they've been doing that for a long time, and the reception is not there. I mean, they'll never be able to sell this to the public, and I think they're increasingly realize that. But the kind of disinformation that you have with, like David Keith doing his Arizona test, Dr. David Keith from Stanford or Harvard, that's simply all a red herring designed to distract the public. Again, geoengineeringwatch.org, our site, the biggest in the world, site traffic over 32 million, which did put us at the top of a Google ranking. If you search the term geoengineering, and our subheading was exposing the climate engineering cover-up, we went from the top of the page on Google 8 weeks ago, gone. Gone from 19 pages. It goes banned on everything. You try to search our articles, you can't. You find someone else to post our article, you have a hard time finding us. Facebook, everybody has completely tried to shadow ban us off the scale. Now, if you search Bing, DuckDuckGo, or other search engines, we're half the top of the first page, as our rating should dictate. But Google has completely censored us off their whole platform.
Wow.
Okay. Thank you, Dane.
Thank you, Craig.
Okay, and Cheryl.
Dan, I just wanted to have I have a comment and a question. And the comment is, I was watching a TV Western from 1956, like a few weeks ago, and they had chemtrails in the sky in this movie. It was 1956, and I was looking at it. I said, oh, my God, I said, there they are. So just kind of date it.
two answers to that question. One, we know these, as I explained to Craig, we know that these programs were operational since at least the mid-1940s. Two, we absolutely see and have proof of these background images being placed in certain productions, even older productions like this, where we see them appearing now, and we have some examples of them before and after. So they were definitely added to the footage. We have kids' films, Over the Hedge, Cars, various kids' animated films. They're all in the background everywhere. It's a form of trying to give plausible denial, if you will. And one element to add to the plausible denial factor, I'll make this very brief, but it backs up what I'm stating. We believe coal fly ash is being used as a base material for the operations because that serves for another form of geoengineering called ocean fertilization, which we believe is also going on. Data indicates that. And so you have elements in coal fly ash. It gets rid of the buildup of that contaminant, for one, gives plausible deniability, too, because they can blame it all on the coal-fired power plants, and not that the coal-fired plants are in any sense benign. But, and three, to add to that, we have record of coal fly ash being imported in sea containers from China to the U.S. Now, why in the world would they import China's coal fly ash unless to use that in air quality testing and to blame it all on China, as if these aerosols could migrate across the Pacific, which in most cases they can't. Mercury can, because mercury converts to a gaseous state, so we would expect that to migrate all the way from China to us, but not some of these other heavy metals, aluminum, barium, and so forth. So back to your film. I can't state on that whatever particular film you saw, but we do have record of some films having background additions put on that appear to be part of the attempt to condition the population. We have NASA has classes for schools for kids to teach them that these are just benign natural phenomenon. I mean, it's very twisted, but you can see that right. The degree to which they're committed to hiding this issue is immense.
Yes, and thank you for that. And then I just have one other question. Do you have any data on the health effects on humans of all of this?
Yes. The effects are beyond horrific. Now, I think anybody in this call seems very educated, so I think everybody understands the harm from air particulate pollution. But in the case of these particulates, they are exponentially more harmful still. Why? One, they're incredibly toxic materials, aluminum, barium, strontium, manganese. But two, their size. We estimate, based on patents and testing, between 20 and 50 nanometers. They're unimaginably small. Smaller the particulate, the more harmful it is. The more bioavailable it is, which means it's more readily absorbed, the more bioaccumulative it is, the more it builds up in our systems. And we also have synergistic toxicity. That's an important term to understand. So we all know aluminum is extremely harmful for us. We know mercury is extremely harmful for us by themselves. When you mix these metals together, based on peer-reviewed study, the toxicity can increase as much as 10,000%, 100 times worse. We have internationally recognized neurologists like Dr. Russell Blaylock, and this is in our data. We have his testimony in our data, stating on the record that these particles are so small they enter right to the nasal passages into the olfactory nerve, into the bloodstream, cross the blood-brain barrier. The harm these particles cause is absolutely irreparable and immense. It is affecting all of us, and every human test subject we've tested, hair, blood, urine, is packed with these metals, packed.
And
we know, one more statistic, we know that Alzheimer's and dementia, for example, now officially being acknowledged in the UK, number one cause of death. Mm-hmm. We know from peer-reviewed study from Scott Exley and others, Dr. Scott Exley, that without aluminum in the equation, regardless of all other factors, there would be no Alzheimer's in the normal human lifespan of 100 years. So what we have here is nothing short of biological warfare as well. Whether intended or not, that's what it is.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, that is an incredibly heavy thought to be leaving us with, but I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dean, for sharing all of this with us, for spending the evening. And hopefully, again, if you want to give that website one more time so people can understand how to get there quickly if they want to get more information, which I'm sure many of us do.
Geoengineeringwatch.org. Very important to put the watch in there, geoengineeringwatch.org, because geoengineering.org is a pro-geoengineering website. We are geoengineeringwatch.org. All data, no politics, no advertising.
Okay. All right.
Thank
so
you,
hopefully,
guys.
Yep.
My gratitude to everybody
much,
in the call. Thank you very much for being willing to address
so
this
much.
Most critical issue.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Dane. Yeah.
Bye, everyone. Take care.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, what we should do now, I think, is give Barbara a brief opportunity to give us that update she was interested in sharing with us. So let's see if we can unmute Barbara.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, you can. Okay. All right. Well, that's a hard act to follow, gang. I'm kind of wiped out. Well, I would like to make a comment about, I'm sorry Dean left the call. I will give you my update in a couple of sentences, but I think people need to know that one of the things that shocked me when I was a senior journalist for the Pentagon at the Naval Postgraduate School for those 16 years, there was a conference that I attended. It was an assignment, and there was a scientist there who, now this fact is probably known to a lot of you, but it wasn't to me at the time, and I was absolutely overwhelmed by it. But I think it's related. I will communicate it to Dean off of the call, obviously. He probably already knows. But this is what was communicated at that conference. It came up through a question in the Q&A session from an academic presenter, multiple PhD scholar and professor. And the fact that was revealed was that before the Trinity test at, I think that was Alamogordo, anyway, New Mexico, right? Anyway, the Trinity test, that first atomic bomb test, Oppenheimer was approached by multiple mathematical physicists and experimental physicists. He was approached and he was told that based upon their calculations, this was the first test there ever was, it was basically an atmospheric test because it was on the ground. He was told that according to their calculations, that these mathematical physicists could not guarantee that atomic test, the first one, would not ignite the atmosphere of the planet and kill everything that had to breathe. And the top, I forget what it was, the 50 feet of the ocean, something like that. Wipe out all of life. And they went ahead. Now, I raised that. There's a mentality here that is almost impossible to comprehend. Mm-hmm. So you have to ask yourself, if the goal really, if there is some sinister plan here to literally end life on this planet, all of it?
Mm-hmm.
Why would they be doing it in this very, elongated way? Why would they take so much time by putting stuff in the atmosphere and zapping it with microwaves? But it seems to me there's something similar to the mentality behind both of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to put that on the record. And if anybody has, in a future call or, offline, if you have any idea what this mentality might be, for God's sake. I mean, they went ahead with this test. And they were told this, and by the way, I raised this when Oliver Stone came out with his series. It was both the book with the professor back in, I can't remember his name, begins with a K. So Oliver Stone's book, The Hidden History of the United States, and his, I believe, 12-part video series. I went to both of their it was Daniel Ellsberg, Oliver Stone, and Professor, his co-author of the book, The Hidden History of the United States. I went to their lecture, sat in the front row because I know Daniel Ellsberg. And in the Q's and A's, I think this is online. I can send it to anyone who's interested. It's actually on YouTube, the talk and my question and the answer. And the professor
answered the question. I raised this fact that I had been told at the Naval Postgraduate School by this presenter at a conference. And he not only confirmed it, he's the ultimate historian on this, but he not only confirmed it, but he goes into the details of how many people were warned, including President Truman, and they went ahead. What is this mentality?
Yes.
What is really going on?
That's a question, Barb, but we really need to get out to the update here. So
okay, no, I understand that. I mean, I think it's important for people to understand. Okay. Update on, it seems trivial by comparison to talk about 9/11 truth, frankly, after this. But it is also important, although I don't think as important. But anyway, everybody here knows that on November 7th, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, of which I'm on the board, and very centrally knowledgeable and active, that we received a letter from the U.S. Attorney for the federal court jurisdiction there for Ground Zero, the Southern District of New York Federal Court. We received this letter saying that they would convene a special criminal grand jury to investigate the true causes of the collapses of World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. So you know that. And then beginning in approximately, I think it was the 11th of December, another historic act took place. And that is that, for those of you who don't know, for the first time in their history, since they were inaugurated in 2005, 2006, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage's organization, has formally, officially, publicly partnered with our Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. We are in the middle right now of a joint fundraising drive for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. So we have been doing just dozens of online and otherwise, broadcast radio interviews, doing one with Scott Bennett on Friday, doing one with Susan Lindauer again on Sunday, and Richard Gage has had his volunteers from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth reach out to something over 300 radio talk show hosts. The bottom line is, if anyone knows of a radio talk show host or TV or any media, mainstream or alternative of any kind, this is our joint fundraising drive. In the first 48 hours, the first week of our month-long fundraising, joint fundraising drive, we met our target, our stated target of $50,000. And we're way over that now. So we desperately need these funds to succeed with the grand jury project. So let me know. Anybody who knows anybody where Richard Gage and myself and the attorneys from the 9/11 Lawyers Committee, if we can go on, we would like to do that and invite people to donate to the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. So that's the update.
Okay. So that brings us to announcements. Does anyone let's get out of Q&A here so everybody can. Okay, so anybody else have an announcement of any type that you wish to share with the rest of us?
Yeah, I have an announcement. Nita Renfrew.
Go ahead, Nita. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'd like to see Gilad Atzmon was on at the last teleconference that we had. I'd like to recommend that everybody go to his website and listen to his Christmas message and then the post-Christmas message, because what he did was very important. He was banned from appearing in the Christmas concert that he usually appears in with the Blockheads, which is a group that he's been playing jazz with for many years. Because there were complaints that he was an anti-Semite and he should not be allowed to participate in the concert. So what he did was he dressed up as Santa Claus and appeared in the conference. And I think that's really ingenuous. So people recognized his playing once Santa Claus began playing, but he did play in the conference. So I recommend that everybody watch that, because I think that's a very important way of beating them.
Yes.
How
Nita,
do we
what's
find
his
it?
Website?
Well, it's he sent it out with his email, with his newsletter. But I guess you go to Gilad Atzmon, his website. You'll find it on Gmail. I don't think it's been taken away. Are you there, Gilad? He was on earlier. I guess he's not on. It's a lot later in London.
It looks like he's still on, but...
Well, there's two people under that, and one of them's Nita, so
okay.
I'm not sure. I think it just means that somebody's on Skype. Nita's probably our last Skype. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's Barb. I would like to announce that Gilad, as I mentioned earlier on this call, Gilad is beginning a West Coast tour of the United States again. If he's on, he can tell you where he's going to be speaking all of the places, but he's going to be speaking in Monterey, California on Friday, January 4th, starting at 12:30 p.m., you know, during the lunch hour, here in Seaside, California, the Monterey Peninsula, for anyone who's anywhere close to the area. And I'm very close, hopefully, tomorrow to booking him also that night, Friday, January 4th, around 7:30 in Santa Cruz.
Okay. Any other announcements?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Okay. I just wanted to let you know I joined the call a while back. This is Sherry in San Diego. I'm the Skype person.
Oh, thank you, Sherry. We appreciate knowing who that was. Okay.
Thank you.
Did you get her name okay, Craig? You muted. All right. Well, anyway, so I guess that brings us to the end of our teleconference. I think that's all the announcements, sounds like, and all the updates. So we'll look forward to the last Wednesday of January for our next teleconference and see you all then. Have a great month. Happy New Year, everybody.
Thank you.
Good
night. Happy New Year, everyone.
And Merry Christmas. It's still Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
That's
Merry
true.
Christmas. Right.
Merry Christmas.
12 days.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.